Welcome to another episode of Jamaican Gangster. On today's episode, we're featuring Wayne Smith, better known as Sandokan. If you're not following us, we would be honored if you would consider doing so. It costs you nothing to hit that button so that you'll be notified every time we release a new episode. Now, let's get into it. Before dawn, on November 19, 1986, Olympic Gardens Police Station was supposed to be the place people ran toward when danger came. But on that morning, danger came for the station itself. The street was still dark, the kind of dark that sits heavy over Kingston before the first vendors move, before the buses start coughing, before the heat begins rising from the road. Inside the compound, five officers were present. Some were assigned to duty. Some were resting. The station was not built like a fortress. It was a police station in a hard community, but on that morning, it became a target. Then the gunfire started. Automatic fire tore through the compound. Molotov cocktails came with it. The wooden parts of the building began to burn. The station, the symbol of state authority in that corner of St. Andrew, was under siege. Acting Corporal Ezra Cummings was shot. Constable Raymond Thomas was shot. District Constable Archibald Robinson was shot inside the station near the Criminal Investigation Branch office. Constable Derek Levy survived by taking refuge in his barracks room and staying there until much later in the day. By the time the attack ended, three policemen were dead. The armory had been broken open. Two M16 rifles, two submachine guns, three revolvers, and ammunition were gone. And the name moving through Kingston was Sandokan. That was the moment Wayne Smith stopped being only a wanted man in street conversation and became something colder. He became a signal, a warning, a story people lowered their voices to tell. Some gangsters build their names in public. They sit on corners. They hand out money. They control parties. They stand beside politicians when the cameras are not too close. But Sandokan came to represent a different shape of fear. He was not remembered as polished. He was not remembered as a neighborhood statesman. He was remembered like a shadow from the middle years of the 1980s. A man whose name traveled ahead of him. Some people said his name alone could change the feeling inside a dance. Not because everybody had seen him. Not because everybody knew the full truth. But because fear does not need paperwork to move. It only needs enough people to believe silence is safer than speech. Wayne Smith rose out of a time when sections of Kingston and St. Andrew were already carrying years of political violence, police pressure, gang control, poverty, and survival logic. Waterhouse, Olympic Gardens, Tower Hill, Riverton City, and surrounding communities were not abstract places on a crime map. They were homes. They were yards. They were mothers, sending children to school, through streets where power changed hands without a vote. They were old people sitting behind zinc fences, listening to footsteps, engines, and gunshots, trying to tell from sound alone whether the danger was passing or arriving. In that world, the police were not always seen as protection. Armed gangs were not always seen as enemies by everyone. The truth was uglier than that. Residents were trapped between forces that both claimed authority. Police operations brought fear. Gang rule brought fear. Some people wanted order so badly that when a violent man punished other violent men, they mistook terror for protection. That is where a figure like Sandokan becomes possible. The record says Wayne Smith, called Sandokan, was tied to a gang that ruled Waterhouse and surrounding areas in the mid-1980s. The community stories around him became complicated fast. Some described him as ruthless. Some claimed he brought a kind of order after other armed men had terrorized residents. Some said he was not careless with old people and children. Others remembered only the violence, the intimidation, and the way his presence deepened the fear already sitting over the area. That contradiction is part of the story. Because the Jamaican gangster is rarely born only from personal cruelty, he is often born from a broken arrangement where people do not trust the state enough, fear the gunman too much, and learn to survive by choosing which danger to live beside. Sandokan came from that arrangement. Then he made it worse. The police had been looking for him before the Olympic Gardens attack. One version repeated in reporting says the tension sharpened after police searched for him and detained or mistreated the woman close to him. The story passed through the streets with heat on it. In that telling, Sando Khan believed the police had humiliated someone he considered his own. Whether every detail reached the ground cleanly or not, the result was clear. By the next morning, Olympic Gardens police station had been attacked. This was not a small act of defiance. This was not a gunman firing at a patrol and running into an alley. This was a direct strike on the state. The attackers studied weakness. They knew when the station would be vulnerable. They came armed. They used fire. They killed policemen. They took weapons from the armory. In a country already familiar with political gunmen and garrison power, this still landed differently. The question was no longer only, where is Sando Khan hiding? The deeper question was, who was strong enough, foolish enough, or desperate enough to attack a police station and believe he would survive the answer? That question followed him. After the attack, the full weight of law enforcement turned toward Sando Khan and those accused of helping him. Police pressure intensified. Communities already tense became more tense. Every raid created more fear. Every rumor created more silence. Every search pushed the Sando Khan story deeper into the streets. And the strange thing about a fugitive is that absence makes the legend grow. When a man is standing in front of you, he has limits. He has a face. He has a height. He has habits. But when he disappears, he becomes whatever fear needs him to be. One person sees him near Riverton. Another swears he passed through Tower Hill. Another claims he had men carrying messages. Another says he had protection. Another says nobody protected him. People only feared what would happen if they gave him up. That is how Sando Khan became phantom-like. He was not invisible. He was hunted. He was named. He was charged. He was placed before the court. But in the public imagination, he moved like something harder to hold. At trial, the case did not depend on street legend. It depended on the killing of three police officers at Olympic Gardens police station. The court record placed Wayne Smith, known as Sandokan, beside Nicholas Henry as an accused man in a case that carried the weight of murder, fire, stolen police weapons, and national embarrassment. The evidence against Henry included a caution statement. In that statement, Henry admitted knowing the co-accused. He described men with automatic weapons and handguns. He described Molotov cocktails being made. He described the co-accused saying he planned to kill named police officers and burn the station. He described armed men leaving for Olympic Gardens police station and later returning with more weapons than they had before. That record matters because it strips away the fog for a moment. Behind the street name, behind the whispers, behind the image of the phantom, there was a real station, real officers, real families, and a real mourning that ended with three dead policemen and a community thrown into deeper fear. The myth is always louder than the victims. That is why the story has to slow down here. Acting Corporal Ezra Cummings was not a symbol when he died. Constable Raymond Thomas was not a headline when he died. District Constable Archibald Robinson was not a piece of gangster folklore when he died. They were men at work in a dangerous place, and the attack that killed them left families behind who had to live with the cost, long after Kingston moved on to the next name. That is the part gangster legend tries to swallow. It remembers the boldness of the attack. It remembers the fugitive. It remembers the fear. But the dead do not get to become myths in the same way. Their absence is quieter, and because it is quieter, it is easier for the culture to step over it. Sando Khan was convicted and sentenced to death. For many people, that should have been the end. The state had answered. The court had spoken. The gallows waited. But Sando Khan's story was never going to end cleanly. On June 15, 1988, he escaped from death row at St. Catherine District Prison. That sentence alone explains why the legend survived. Death row was supposed to be final. It was supposed to be the place a condemned man waits under state control. But Sando Khan got out. Four prison warders were suspended after the escape, and an investigation followed. On the street, the questions became louder than the facts. Who helped him? Who looked away? Who had enough reach to open space inside a prison built to hold condemned men? Nothing grows a legend faster than a locked door opening when it should not. After the escape, Sando Khan was no longer only the man accused and convicted in the police station attack. He became the man who walked away from death row. For the police, that made him a crisis. For the street, it made him almost supernatural. For the communities around him, it meant the pressure would not stop. The manhunt continued. In July 1988, he was shot and wounded by police near Spanish Town Road and Riverton City, but he escaped again. That survival added another layer to the fear. It made him look untouchable to some people and dangerous to everyone else. But survival is not the same as control. A fugitive lives inside shrinking space. Every friend becomes a risk. Every hideout becomes a trap. Every old alliance starts asking whether sheltering him is worth the heat he brings. The same name that once opened doors begins closing them. The same fear that protected him begins attracting men who want him gone. This is where the Sando Khan story turns from power into consequence. By then, the streets were not only afraid of police raids. They were afraid of being caught between fugitives, gangs, informers, and men trying to prove loyalty through blood. Once a man becomes the most hunted name in the country, everybody near him starts paying part of the price. Reports from that period tied Sando Khan to more violence after his escape. The stories around Riverton City grew darker. One reported killing involved Moses Bent, called Bretta. Another involved a 16-year-old named Robert Winter, taken from his house, accused of giving information, and killed in a brutal act that even years later remained one of the ugliest pieces of the Sando Khan memory. That is where the image of the protector collapses. Whatever order people once claimed he brought, whatever protection some residents once believed he offered, the logic of the gun always travels in the same direction. First, it claims to defend the community, then it controls the community, then it punishes the community. Then the community learns that even children are not safe from suspicion. That is not protection, that is captivity. And captivity was the real atmosphere around the phantom of the 80s. Sando Khan did not need to be present in every yard for people to feel him. His name carried the threat. His escape carried the embarrassment. His violence carried the lesson. And the police response carried its own fear through the communities that had to endure the searches, the pressure, and the suspicion. This was the transition period. The older political gunman had often been visible through party colors, garrison lines, and open neighborhood command. Sando Khan represented something more unstable. He existed in the space where the gangster was becoming less publicly political and more mysterious, more mobile, more rumor-driven, more like a name passed from mouth to mouth after dark. That did not make him more powerful in the long run. It made him harder to understand while he was moving, and that mystery thread returns here. After the police station attack, after the conviction, after the escape from death row, after the reported shootings, the same question still sits under the story. Who benefited from Sando Khan staying alive? Maybe nobody benefited for long. Maybe the street only thought it did. Maybe some men believed his name protected their side until the police pressure became unbearable. Maybe some saw him as useful until he became too visible. Maybe the phantom was never protected by loyalty at all. Maybe he was protected by fear. And fear is never loyal. It only waits for a safer master. On September 8, 1988, Sando Khan's body was found in bushes in Tower Hill. He had been shot multiple times. The belief reported afterward was that members of another gang had killed him. In the street version, the man who escaped the gallows met what people called jungle justice. The state had sentenced him to death, but the streets carried it out first. That ending fits the world that made him. Not because it was justice in any clean sense. Not because it repaired the lives lost at Olympic Gardens. Not because it healed the communities that lived under gun rule. It fit because men like Sando Khan often rise in places where official justice is weak, feared, delayed, or distrusted. Then they die inside the same disorder they helped strengthen. The phantom did not vanish. He was left in Tower Hill. And after that, the story kept moving without him. The younger names came. The next gangs came. The next police operations came. The next mothers pulled children inside. The next dances lowered their lights. The next community learned the same lesson in a new voice. Sandokan's reign was not long, but it landed with force because of what it revealed. It showed that a Jamaican gangster did not need to hold a minister's hand in public to terrify a city. He did not need a long speech, a public office, or a polished image. In the 1980s, when political violence, poverty, police distrust, and street power were already tangled together, a man could become a legend through dread alone. That is why his name still carries weight in the old stories. Not because he built something lasting, not because he left a community stronger, not because he defeated the state. He did not. His story remains because he exposed how fragile safety had become. A police station could burn. A condemned man could escape. A community could be trapped between the gunman and the raid. A name could become so heavy that people remembered the fear longer than they remembered the facts. That is the real warning inside Sandokan. The myth says he was the phantom of the 80s. The truth is worse. He was not a ghost. He was a man produced by a system already sick with violence, silence, politics, poverty, revenge, and fear. And when that system finished using him, it did what it has done to many men who thought terror made them untouchable. It left him with nowhere safe to stand. That was the story of Sandokan. If this episode moved you, if it taught you something, if it kept you up, share it. Follow us if you haven't already. And stay close, because on the next episode of Jamaican Gangster, we are going somewhere you are not ready for.